Hi, it's Fraser here. What you're about to hear is the audio from a video we've just published on our YouTube channel, an interview with David Frost, the former chief Brexit negotiator, on Keir Starmer's surrender deal. To make sure you never miss great content like this, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/spiked.
Brexit Minister Lord Frost.
Our country is now sovereign again.
Crucial part of Boris Johnson's government.
This is an extremely bad deal.
This deal is a win-win.
Given the way that the team were taken to the cleaners in the last few days, I would expect further concessions.
We're turning a page. We're opening a new chapter.
Why have we paid such a high price in sovereignty and control?
Seems increasingly unlikely that we will have a Conservative government. On the day we're speaking, a poll has put your party in fourth place.
We've got to get serious. I don't yet see the evidence for it.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Lord David Frost, the former chief Brexit negotiator under Boris Johnson and a Conservative life peer. Welcome, David.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're speaking in the week that Keir Starmer has agreed his Brexit reset. Now, the Prime Minister has described this as a win-win for both sides. Do you think he's right?
Well, it depends what you're trying to win, I guess, is the honest answer. It's certainly a win for the EU because it's brought significant areas of our economic life back under their control. If you're somebody like Keir Starmer who sees the purpose in his life and in this country's existence in getting closer to the EU, then that's a win as well. But for those like me who don't, this is an extremely bad deal. Takes us, you know, well, a big step back towards further EU control and really should be resisted.
Should we talk about some of the specifics? Should we start with fishing? Because that seems to be the big headline. The Sun this morning we're speaking saying Starmer stitched us up like a kipper. What's happened there? Why is that? What's the scale of the betrayal on that front?
Well, I'm really amazed by it, to be honest, that they're willing to agree quite so long a sort of concession. When we agreed this back in 2020, we agreed a 5.5 year transition, and it is quite normal in free trade agreements to have transition arrangements from one to the other. It was a bit longer than we really wanted. We'd hoped for 2 or 3, but it was a wider agreement, and we did that. The key point about that was after the 5.5 years, it finished and we got full control back of our waters. Now, what Starmer has done is simply extend this transition for another 12 years, giving the EU rights to fish in our waters on that basis, you know, for an extremely long time. Mm. There's no way we would have agreed a 17.5 year transition period. That is effectively carrying on the arrangements. And yet that's what Starmer has agreed.
And what about food? That seems to bring us directly under the oversight of the European Court of Justice. For people who maybe have not been following the Brexit debate or have forgotten some of these institutions after 9 years, what does that mean in practice?
So it means that it's obvious that if you're exporting food to the EU, you have to meet EU standards. Nobody's ever argued with that, and it's true in the free trade agreement. What this SPS area means is that for everything in this country, we have to follow EU laws on SPS agri-food without a say. So if you're a trader who never exports to the EU, tough, you still got to follow EU rules with all this process and bureaucracy. You can't liberalize, you can't change, we can't bring in laws that are different to the EU's, and we can't let in goods from any other country that don't meet EU standards, even if we're quite happy with it ourselves.
And SPS, that's sanitary and phytosanitary.
That's right. That's what it stands for.
And
yes.
Basically, so food and animal products.
Food and animal products. Yes.
And in terms of one of the hidden aspects, I think that's been under discussed, but you mentioned this in your recent Telegraph piece, is the deal on energy, which is quite extraordinary considering that we have incredibly high energy prices in the UK. It looks as if we're going to do a deal with the EU that will bring them even higher.
That's right. It has been under discussed so far, oddly, but it needs exposing. And what we've agreed to is to join the Europeans emission trading scheme. Again, their rules, their say, we're just part of it. Their carbon price is about 50% higher than ours, so that's a problem in itself. But we've also agreed that we will never have net zero targets and ambitions which are less ambitious than those of the EU.
Yeah.
So if we want to escape net zero, and I really think we need to, we can only do it if the EU says that's okay. And I think we know what they would say in those circumstances.
A big fat no. Yeah. And so really we are talking about a huge amount of sovereignty, a huge amount of decision-making power given away by this deal.
Yes, that's right. I mean, of course, it is a political agreement. Mm. It sets out the kind of parameters. It's not a legal text. That negotiation still has to be done. You know, given the way that the team were taken to the cleaners in the last few days, you know, I would expect them to make further concessions as this gets drafted into to legal text. The EU knows how to put the pressure on. They know we can't retreat from this now, having made such a thing about it. So I think this deal's only going to get worse rather than better as it becomes a binding text.
And what about some of the purported wins? For instance, Starmer's making a big show, song and dance about this defence pact coming into view. What do you make of things like that?
I mean, the defence pact is, it kind of, there are two critiques, perhaps, to that people make of this. One is that the risk that you get sucked into EU arrangements without any say. The other is the one that I currently kind of feel, having looked at the text, which is this is a sort of big fat nothing, really. Yeah. It's just a right to attend a load of meetings, possibly be invited to join one or two of their institutions, and generally sort of psychologically and diplomatically turn back towards the EU again. But, you know, we can go to meetings anyway. We are going to these meetings already. You know, why have we paid such a high price in sovereignty and control just to be allowed to sort of talk about foreign policy and defence with the Europeans, which we can do anyway? We talk about foreign policy and defence with the Americans, with the Indians, all sorts of people. We don't have to be part of their, you know, sort of legal arrangements to achieve it. So, you know, really, although it's kind of talked up, I really don't see that this is anything worth paying a price for. And of course, that's why we didn't agree to it in 2020.
And it does seem that that is the kind of thing that is so attractive to Starmer, being able to sort of be the statesman on the world stage. He said Britain is back on the world stage was one of his the big quotes from the meeting. They still seem very starry-eyed about the EU as if it's, you know, this dynamic, prosperous engine of growth. Why do they, does that view square with reality?
I mean, it really is a deeply ingrained view amongst, you know, the political class in Britain that Europe does a lot of things better. You know, they have beautiful public transport and beautiful cities and, you know, beautiful countryside and all this sort of thing. And you know, it's kind of deeply rooted in the way they see things. And I think a lot of it goes back, you know, quite a long way, and they've simply not absorbed that, you know, for large parts of the last sort of 40 years, Britain was doing much better than Europe economically. So I think it's just a kind of hangover. It's a bit of a sort of cultural cringe. It's just a refusal to look reality in the face, and, you know, the disaster zone that the euro is, the, you know, the rise of anti-system parties throughout Europe because people increasingly feel they can't change anything at their elections. So they're trying to knock the whole thing down. This is a recipe for really bad politics and really poor economics. And I just don't understand why, you know, the great tradition of Labour, you know, which is about prosperity for working people, you know, why you would want to get yourself enmeshed in that again. I don't understand it.
Yeah. And also, Starmer has been fairly slippery on these issues. I mean, of course, we know that his heart is really with the EU. He obviously spearheaded the campaign for a second referendum. But since before the election, he'd been talking almost like a born again Brexiteer. You know, he's constantly talking about taking back control. Even just last week, he gave an immigration speech talking about finally taking back control. what kind of damage does that do to people's trust in politics when someone can so clearly, you know, speak in one language and then their actions totally betray them within such a short period of time?
Yeah. I mean, it is remarkable. And, you know, one's forced to conclude that Starmer just kind of says what's convenient for him. You know, it's a critique that he was very willing to make of Boris at times. And, but he seems to be doing the same thing himself. Everybody can see what sort of person Keir Starmer is. He's a lawyer, he's an international lawyer. He believes in international law. He doesn't have any instinctive feeling, as far as I can see, for kind of, you know, British sovereignty, British culture, British history, what made this country what it is. It's just a kind of place to operate from, as far as he's concerned. And, you know, I just don't think this take back control will resonate, you know, plausibly with people in any way. And, you know, trust in policy is already really low, and this sort of thing just makes it worse. I really think that, you know, people in this country, voters, sense that something is going wrong in the politics and economics of this country, and they don't necessarily know exactly why. But I think there's an appetite for politicians who will kind of tell it like it is. These are the problems. These are the things we're going to have to fix. It may not be easy, but this is how we can do it. And to kind of to be honest with people.
Yeah.
And we're just not getting that honesty at the moment.
And returning to the Brexit deal, the deal you negotiated with the Conservatives, I mean, I'm sure you admit that it's not perfect. It's not, but what would, if you were to do a reset, what would that look like? Is one necessary? But what would it look like if you will?
I don't think that a reset is necessary for the trade deal, the big trade deal that we negotiated in 2020 after we'd left formally. You know, that is a huge trade deal. Actually, it covers all sorts of other things as well, as security, aviation, road transport. You know, the health card that you carry is in that trade deal. You know, it's extremely broad.
Yeah.
You know, there are kind of odd things one could shave off the edge, but fundamentally I don't think it needs any change. It certainly doesn't need a big full dress international negotiation. It just needs kind of ongoing discussion and chat about it, and that's what happens with most trade deals. The thing that we would have liked to have done but never could, of course, was get rid of the Northern Ireland arrangements, which we tried to get rid of in 2019, but because Parliament said you couldn't leave the EU without an agreement, we in the end had to go along with the agreement that the EU would accept. Otherwise, we'd still be in the EU. We tried again in 2020 with the UK internal market bill that would have overridden key parts of the protocol. Again, Parliament wouldn't live with that. And at each time, you know, these very constraining arrangements that have kept Northern Ireland in the single market and EU customs area, you know, they provide a disincentive to do things differently because you open up a gap within the country. Every time we've tried to remove those, Parliament has said no. And in the end, Rishi Sunak decided on a quiet life and agreed to those arrangements. And since then, it's been a problem. So that's what we would really like to have changed and still does need to change. But the fundamentals of the trade arrangement, I think, are fine.
And in terms of this new deal, of course, the legal stuff hasn't been fully signed off yet, as you said. But isn't it implied that it locks us into, you know, the fishing deal goes way beyond the next parliament? The Conservatives and Reform have both said they'll overturn it. But won't they encounter a lot of difficulties in doing that if it does bind you, you know, for instance, into this 12-year fishing deal?
So one of the issues is going to be, is this new deal going to be a sort of freestanding international agreement kind of bolted on to the trade agreement, or will they incorporate it into the trade agreement by kind of adding it to the different chapters of the trade agreement? Now, it sounds technical, but it isn't, because if it's a freestanding kind of agreement, it should have, we hope, a withdrawal clause. If it doesn't, that will be a big problem, which will enable you to withdraw from it. If it's kind of mixed in the trade deal, it may mean that you could only get rid of these new provisions by kind of collapsing bits of the whole trade agreement
right.
under those withdrawal clauses, which is quite, you know, would be undesirable, I think. So we need to work out how this is going to be done. Mm. And if it is in the trade deal, you know, it'll be politically more difficult to do. It still has to be done. And that's why it's so important to say now it won't stand. You know, EU, you better get ready for the idea that it won't stand because we're not going to abide by it. That needs to be said consistently and consistently so that we have moral rights on our side when it comes to it.
And finally, I mean, we talked then about what might happen if there's a Conservative or Reform government, but it seems increasingly unlikely that we will have a Conservative government if the polls are to be believed today. On the day we're speaking, a poll has put your party in fourth place. What is your reaction to that? What does that mean for the future of what was one of the what's been the most successful party in British history?
I mean, is at one level it's astonishing, and in another level it isn't. There's a very clear trend here in the latest polls, and you know, the problem is, it seems to me, that the Conservative Party is kind of lost touch with its supporter base, and you know, supporter base is going elsewhere. And the Reform Party is overcoming the problem of the wasted vote increasingly, and people are moving away. And, you know, it's not obvious what the USP of the Conservative Party is anymore. If you want sort of strong conservatism, well, you've got Reform. Mm. If you like sort of, you know, liberal, social liberalism, and you're not so worried about, you know, free markets and so on, then you've got the Lib Dems. What exactly is the mix that the Conservatives are offering? So in 2019, we did have a new mix. Mm. We had a different sort of supporter base that bought a genuine majority across the country, but we let that go. And now the social base of the Conservative Party seems to be, you know, basically wealthy property owners in Southeast England. And unfortunately, you can't win the election with those people. So we've got to get serious. Mm. And, I don't yet see the evidence for it.
David Frost, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.